Why not?
Harry Coyne whined.
You got nothing to gain by killing me. Take the money and put me off this sub at the first island you pass.
Well?
Hagbard said thoughtfully, counting the money.
I can get more,
Harry added.
I can send it to you.
I'm sure.
Hagbard put the money in his clamshell ashtray and struck a match. There was a brief merry blaze, and Hagbard asked calmly,
Do you have any other inducements to offer?
I tell you anything you want to know about the Illuminati.
Harry shrieked, really frightened now, realizing that he was in the hands of a madman to whom money meant nothing.
I know more about the Illuminati than you do.
Hagbard replied, looking bored.
Give me a philosophic reason, Harry. Is there any purpose in allowing a specimen like you to go on preying on the weak and innocent?
Honest, I'll go straight. I'll join your side. I'll work for you. Kill anybody you want.
That's a possibility,
Hagbard conceded.
It's a slim one, though. The world is full of killers and potential killers. Thanks to the Illuminati and their governments, there's hardly an adult male alive who hasn't had some military training. What makes you think I couldn't go out on the streets of any large city and find 10 better qualified killers than you inside an afternoon?
Okay,
Harry said, breathing hard.
I don't have no college education, but I'm not a fool either. Your men dragged me from Mad Dog Jail to this submarine. You want something, Ace? Otherwise, I'd be dead already.
Yes, I want something.
Hagbard leaned back in his chair.
Now you're getting warm, Harry. I want something, but I won't tell you what it is. You've got to produce it and show it to me without any clues or hints. And if you can't do that, I really will have you killed. I shit you not, fellow. This is my version of a trial for your past crimes. I'm the judge and the jury, and you've got to win an acquittal without knowing the rules. How do you like that game?
It ain't fair.
It's more of a chance than you gave any of the men you shot, isn't it?
Harry Coyne licked his lips.
I think you're bluffing,
he ventured finally.
You're some chicken shit liberal who doesn't believe in capital punishment. You're looking for an excuse to not kill me.
Look into my eyes, Harry. Do you see any mercy in them?
Coyne began to perspire and finally looked down into his lap.
Okay,
he said hollowly.
How much time do I have?
Hagbard opened his drawer and took out his revolver. He cracked it open, showing the bullets, and quickly snapped it closed again. He slipped the safety catch, a procedure he later found unnecessary with George Dorn, who knew nothing about guns, and aimed at Harry's belly.
3 days and 3 minutes are both too long,
he said casually.
If you're ever going to get it, you're going to get it now.
Mama,
Coyne heard himself exclaim.
You're going to shit your pants in a moment,
Hagbard said coldly.
Better not. I find bad smells offensive, and I might shoot you just for that. And Mama isn't here, so don't call her again.
Coyne saw himself lunging across the room, the gun roaring in mid-leap, but at least trying to get his hands on this bastard's throat before dying.
Pointless.
Hagbard grinned icily.
You'd never get out of the chair.
His finger tightened slightly, and Coyne's gut churned. He knew enough about guns to know how easy it was to have an accident, and he thought of the gun going off even before the bastard Chilean intended it to, maybe even as he was on the edge of guessing the goddamn riddle. The pointlessness of it was the final horror, and he looked again into those eyes without guilt or pity or any weakness he could exploit. Then, for the first time in his life, Harry Coyne knew peace as he relaxed into death.
Good enough,
Hagbard said from far away, snapping the safety back in place.
You've got more on the ball than either of us realized.
Harry slowly came back and looked at that face and those eyes.
God,
he said.
I'm going to give you the gun in a minute,
Hagbard went on.
Then it's my turn to sweat. Of course, if you kill me, you'll never get off this sub alive, but maybe you'll think that's worthwhile just for revenge. On the other hand, maybe you'll be curious about that instant of peace, and you'll wonder if there's an easier way to get back there and if I can teach it to you. Maybe. One more thing before I toss you the gun. Everybody who joins me does it by free choice. When you said you'd come over to my side just because you were afraid of dying, you had no value to me at all. Here's the gun, Harry. Now, I want you to check it. There are no gimmicks, no missing firing pin or anything like that. No other tricks either. Nobody watching you through a peephole and ready to gun you down the minute you aim at me or anything like that. I'm totally at your mercy. What are you going to do?
Harry examined the gun carefully and looked back at Hagbard. He had never studied kinetics and ergonomy as Hagbard had, but he could read enough of the human face and body to know what was going on in the other man. Hagbard had that same peace he himself had experienced for a moment.
"You win, you bastard,"
Harry said, tossing the gun back.
"I want to know how you do it."
"Part of you already knows."
Hagbard smiled gently, putting the gun back in the drawer.
"You just did it, didn't you?"
"What would he have done if I did block?"
Harry asked Stella in present time.
"Something, I don't know. A sudden act of some sort that scared you more than the gun. He plays it by ear. The Chiline system is never twice the same."
"Then I was right. He wouldn't have killed me. It was all bluff."
"Yes and no."
Stella looked past Harry and George into the distance.
"He wasn't acting with you. He was manifesting. The mercilessness was quite real. There was no sentimentality involved in saving you. He did it because it's part of his demonstration."
"His demonstration?"
George asked, thinking of geometry problems and the neat QED at the bottom back in Nutley years and years ago.
"I've known Hagbard longer than she has,"
Eichmann said.
"In fact, Galley and I were among the first people he enlisted. I've watched him over the years, and I still don't understand him. But I understand the demonstration."
"You know,"
George said absently,
"when you two first came in, I thought you were a hallucination."
"You never saw us at dinner because we work in the kitchen,"
Galley explained.
"We eat after everybody else."
"Only a small part of the crew are former criminals,"
Stella told George, who was looking confused.
"Rehabilitating a Harry Coyne, pardon me, Harry, doesn't really excite Hagbard much. Rehabilitating policemen and politicians and teaching them useful trades is work that really turns Hagbard on."
"But not for sentimental reasons,"
Eichmann emphasized.
"It's part of his demonstration."
"It's his memorial to the Mohawk Nation, too,"
Stella said.
"That trial set him off. He tried a direct frontal assault that time, attempting to cut through the logogram with a scalpel. It didn't work, of course. It never does. Then he decided, very well, I'll put them where words can't help, and see what they do then. That's his demonstration." "Hagbard actually, well, not actually, this is just what he told me, had started with two handicaps, intending to prove that they weren't handicaps. The first was that he would have a bank balance of exactly $0.00 at the beginning, and the second was that he would never kill another human being throughout the demonstration. That which was to be proved, namely that government is a hallucination or a self-fulfilling prophecy, could be shown only if all his equipment, including money and people, came to him through honest trade or voluntary association. Under these rules, he could not shoot even in self-defense, for the biogram of government servants was to be preserved, and only their logograms could be disconnected, deactivated, and diffused. The Chiline system was a consistent, although flexible, assault on the specific conditioned reflex, that which compelled people to look outside themselves to a god or a government for direction or strength. The servants of government all carried weapons. Hagbard's insane scheme depended on rendering the weapons harmless. He called this the tar baby principle. You are attached to what you attack. Being a man of certain morbid self-insight, he realized that he himself exemplified the tar baby principle and that his attacks on government kept him perpetually attached to it. It was his malign and insidious notion that government was even more attached to him, that his existence, qua anarchist, qua smuggler, qua outlaw, aroused greater energetic streaming in government people than their existence aroused in him, that, in short, he was the tar baby on which they could not resist hurling themselves in anger and fear. An electrochemical reaction in which he could bond them to himself, just as the tar baby captured anyone who swung a fist at it. More. There was always more with Hagbard. He had been impressed on reading Weishaupt's Überstrip Schnippschnapp, Weltspielen und Fundwissenschaft, by the passage on the Order of Assassins, which read,
Surrounded by Muslim maniacs on one side and Christian maniacs on the other, the wise Lord Hassan preserved his people and his cult by bringing the art of assassination to aesthetic perfection. With just a few daggers strategically placed in exactly the right throats, he found wisdom's alternative to war and preserved the peoples by killing their leaders. Truly, his was a most exemplary life of grandmotherly kindness.
Großmutterlich Gefälligkeit,
muttered Hagbard, who had been reading this in the original German.
Now, where have I heard that before?
In a second he remembered. The Mumon Khan, or Gateless Gate, of Rinzai Zen contained a story about a monk who kept asking a Zen master, "What is the Buddha?" Each time he asked, he got hit upside the head with the master's staff. Finally discouraged, he left and sought enlightenment with another master, who asked him why he had left the previous teacher. When the poor gawk explained, the second master gave him the ontological hotfoot. "Go back to your previous master at once," he cried, and apologized for not showing enough appreciation of his grandmotherly kindness. Hagbard was not surprised that Weishaupt evidently knew, in 1776, when Uber Strip Schnipschnapp was written, about a book which hadn't yet been translated into any European tongue. He was astonished, however, that even the evil Ingolstadt Zauberer had understood the rudiments of the tar baby principle. It never pays to underestimate the Illuminati, he thought then, for the first time. He was to think of it many times in the next 2.5 decades. On April 24th, when he told Stella to deliver some Callisti gold to George's stateroom, Hagbard had already asked Fuckup the odds that Illuminati ships would arrive in Paos within the time he intended to be there. The answer was better than 100-1. He thought about what that meant, then buzzed to have Harry Coyne sent in. Harry swaggered to a chair, trying to look insolent, and said,
"So, you're the leader of the Discordians, eh?"
"Yes,"
Hagbard said evenly.
"And on this ship, my word is law. Wipe that silly grin off your face and sit up straight."
He observed the involuntary stiffening of Harry's body before the man caught himself and remembered to maintain his slouch. Typical, Coyne could resist the key conditioning phrases, but only with effort.
"Listen,"
he said softly.
"I will tell you only one more time."
Another Bavarian fire drill.
"That this is my ship. You will address me as Captain Chiline. You will come to attention when I talk to you. Otherwise..."
He let the phrase trail off. Slowly, Coyne shifted to a more respectful kinesic posture, immediately modifying it by grinning more insolently. Well, that was good. The streak of rebellion ran deep. The breathing was not bad for a professional criminal. The only block seemed to be at the bottom of the exhalation. The grin was a defense against tears, of course, as with most chronic American smilers. Hagbard attempted a probe. Harry's father was the kind who pretended to consider the case and to toy with forgiveness before he would administer the thrashing.
"Is that better?"
Harry asked, accentuating his respectful posture and grinning more sarcastically.
"A little,"
Hagbard said, sounding mollified.
"But I don't know what I'm going to do with you, Harry. That's a bad bunch you've been mixed up with. Very un-American."
He paused to get a reaction to the word. It came at once.
"Their money is as good as anyone's,"
Harry said defiantly. His shoes crept backwards as he spoke, and his neck decreased an inch. The turtle reflex, Hagbard called it, and it was a sure sign of the repressed guilt denied by the man's voice.
"You were born pretty poor, weren't you?"
Hagbard asked in a neutral tone.
"Poor? We was white niggers."
"Well, I guess there's some excuse for you."
Hagbard watched. The grin grew wider. The body imperceptibly moved back towards slouching.
"But to turn on your own country, Harry, that's bad. That's the lowest thing a human being can do. It's like turning against your own mother."
The toes curled inward again, tentatively. What did Harry's father say before wielding the belt? Hagbard caught it.
"Harry,"
he repeated it gravely,
"you haven't been acting like a proper white man. You've been acting like you got nigger blood."
The grin stretched to the breaking point and became a grimace. The body stiffened to the most respectful possible posture.
"Now, look here, sir,"
Harry began.
"You got no call to talk to me that way."
"And you're not even ashamed,"
Hagbard ran over him.
You don't show any remorse!
He shook his head with profound discouragement.
I can't let you wander around loose committing more crimes and treasons. I'm going to have to feed you to the sharks.
Listen, Captain Chiline, sir, I've got a money belt under this shirt, and it's full of more $100 bills than you ever saw at one time.
Are you trying to bribe me?
Hagbard asked sternly. The rest of the scene would be easy, he reflected. Part of his mind drifted to the Illuminati ships he would meet at Paos. There was no way to use the Chiline system without communicating, and he knew the crew would be protected against him by some Illuminati variation on the earwax of Ulysses' men passing the sirens. The money would go in the giant clamshell ashtray, a real shocker for a man like Coin. But what would he do about the Illuminati ships? When the time came to produce the gun, he slipped the safety off viciously. If I'm going to join the ancient brotherhood of killers, he thought morosely, maybe I should have the stomach to start with a visible target.
3 days and 3 minutes are both too long,
he said, trying to sound casual.
If you're ever going to get it, you're going to get it now.
They would be at Paos in less than an hour, he thought, as Coin involuntarily cried,
Mama!
Like Dutch Schultz, Hagbard reflected. Like how many others? It would be interesting to interview doctors and nurses and find out how many people passed out with that primordial cry for the All-Protector on their lips. But Harry finally surrendered, abdicated, left the robot running itself according to the biogram. He was no longer sitting in an insolent slouch, a respectful attention, a guilty cramp. He was simply sitting. He was ready for death.
Good enough,
Hagbard said.
You've got more on the ball than either of us realized.
The man would now transfer his submissive reflexes to Hagbard, and the next stage would be longer and harder before he learned to stop playing roles entirely and just manifest as he had in the face of extinction. The gun gambit was variation number 2 of the third basic tactic in the Chiline system. It had 5 usual sequels. Hagbard picked the most dangerous one. He usually did, since he didn't much like the gun gambit at all and could only stomach it if he gave most of the subjects a chance at the other role. This time, however, he knew he had another motive. Somewhere deep inside, a coward in him hoped Harry Coin was crazier than he had estimated and would, in fact, shoot. That way, Hagbard could avoid the decision awaiting him in Paos.
You win, you bastard,
Coin's voice said. Hagbard came back and quickly rushed through a small verbal game involving hell images picked up from Harry's childhood. When he had Coin sent back to his room under light security, he slouched in his chair and rubbed his eyes tiredly. He probed for Dorn and found the Dalai Lama was on that channel broadcasting.
Leave the kid alone,
he beamed.
It's my turn now. Go contemplate your navel, you old fraud.
A shower of rose petals was the nonverbal answer. The Lama faded out. George went on rapping to himself on the themes planted by the elf leader. Odd, the big red one. I think it was his eye. The eye of Apollo. His luminous eye.
Aye, trust me not,
Hagbard beamed.
Trust not a man who's rich in flax. His morals may be sadly lax. Some of my own doubts getting in here,
he thought.
Her name is Stella Maris, Black Star of the Seas. I won't tell him who she and Mavis really are. George, I want you in the captain's control room.